Welcome to episode 475 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we feature a poignant conversation with Black working class human rights organizer and strategist Nijmi Zarinko. We talk about putting people first and poverty, systemic racism, the Poor People's Campaign mobilization event in Washington, D.C., June 18th. Starting where people are, freedom from criminalization, values, the notion of developing leaders, and understanding your position, among other things. A great conversation with Nijmi Zarinko this go-round. We have an EWSA titled Language and Nuance. We share an excerpt from a story titled The Memory of Clay by Bruce Ballinger, published in the May 2022 edition of The Sun magazine. We have a poem called Bloom On. All of this, of course, will be imbued with the wonderful energy of several great tunes. It is so nice to be with you. Let's get to it. Episode 475 of Troubadours and Raconteurs.
We'll be right back.
language and nuance. How do you measure the weight of one's life? Does any of it truly matter? The onset of malaise started when the existential crisis began, way back after my second divorce, or perhaps even before. I don't know for sure. Please don't change the channel or fast forward. I'm trying to connect with you. There must be someone out there, out here, who understands. I want to make happiness, feel it too. The beauty is quite apparent, the soulfulness, language, and nuance. But it seems like there are so many dunces and jackasses. These beliefs in a cockamamie scheme and shallow, fluffy dreams. I think, therefore, I am lethargic and disheartened at what I see and surmise. It quite likely is me, my limitations, these idiosyncrasies, those inherited missing parts through biology, physiology, and cultural omnipresent incessant pounding. Subtle as well, those influences enter into this unknowing modest structure of organic material my essence calls home. I walk on, trying so hard to be something beyond a scared, selfish drone. Whomever has loved me, and who I loved now and before, was it real? What is life and love? Where does it come from? Where does it lead? What is this need to know? And like a formulaic documentary of some personified human journey, it implies a point of origin and a constant flow. I remember one time sitting on the side of a green grass hill in the state of Vermont.
Hi, Lauren.
Nijmi Zarenko, is that you?
It is me.
So nice to have you on Troubadours and Rock on Tours again.
Thank you.
And for those who have not heard myself and Nijmi talk in the past, let me give you a little background. Nijmi Zarenko is a black working-class human rights organizer and strategist and co-founder of Put People First PA, among other things. And there's some big events coming up. But first, let me ask you, how are things going?
Things are going pretty well overall. Thank you for asking. I'm busy, but, you know, par for the course.
Yeah, the kind of work that you do never ends.
Well, in, you know, God willing, one day it will.
Yeah, I hope. And when I say the kind of work, I mean, you're really, correct me if I'm wrong, generally speaking, you're trying to help out with the disparity in society, the injustice in society, economically speaking, civil rights as well. And there are several organizations in Pennsylvania that you're involved with, and I suppose nationally you're also working with some peers and colleagues. I personally, as of late, have been kind of discouraged about where we are in the United States of America as a society. Do you feel that way too?
I don't generally feel discouraged. I feel like we know what needs to be done, and that is people need to be organized. And so in doing that, I think there's a lot of hope, and I see that every day. It's just that it's hard work. And so I think we need to persevere in that, but I don't feel hopeless. I think that everything is possible if we can get organized, and that's what this upcoming action in D.C. with the Poor People's Campaign is all about.
Yes, the Poor People's Campaign mobilization is in D.C. June 18th. And is that, I guess, mainly based on the name, it's about economics?
Well, it's about all of the things that the Poor People's Campaign, all of the different evils that the Poor People's Campaign is fighting against. So it's about poverty, it's about systemic racism, the destruction of the environment, the war economy, the distorted moral narrative of white Christian nationalism. It's really about all those things in our entire platform, which is sees the interconnections between all of those and doesn't think that they can just be separated into single issues.
Yeah, I think you're right. For sure. They are all interconnected. And do you find it challenging to convince people that that we have common interests and common, I guess, goals that we should be pursuing?
I think that I don't take the posture of convincing. I try to start with where people are and what their experience has been. And so if someone has run into, and I think the vast majority of people have run into the roadblocks that come living in this society with trying to find a place to live that you can afford, or find childcare or healthcare, or be able to have a job that pays a living wage, or get transportation when you need it, or any a number of other things, right? Not to mention freedom of movement and freedom from criminalization and discrimination, all kinds of things. That starting at that point and starting with people's experiences means that they need less convincing, right? Because they've experienced it for themselves firsthand. They may not have experienced everything, but they've experienced something to be able to have a way into understanding how is this actually a systemic problem and not just your individual problem. So I think we've had a lot of success with that approach.
I guess that's a better approach than trying to preach to people. People don't like to be preached to. If you meet them, as you said, where they are, with their experiences, then you're having more of a true connection with that individual or that group. You know, when I'm at my most cynical, Ninjami, I believe often that we are, our species, we're so selfish, you know, especially in the Western world, as far as I understand it, because of consumerism and the whole, you know, the whole system as it is there for us to born into. It's all steeped in materialism, competition, the sense of success, you know, which is about consumption. And it is almost about comparing yourself to others. Are you better? Are you at a higher level? All those things. And it just keeps feeding that, I think, again, when I'm most cynical, that inherent selfishness. That's a bad place to be if you're trying to do what you're doing. Do you think that there's any merit to what I'm saying, or you don't even go there?
I think people are capable of a lot of different things, right? They're capable of great harm, and they're also capable of great good. I think that, like you said, you know, the competition and individualism and consumerism it's in the DNA of this culture and this society, and we all get socialized inside of systems that promote that, a system that really promotes those ideas and that way of being, and also naturalizes it, right? Because it's important for people to think that those qualities are just natural, and not ones that are really elevated by a particular kind of system, right? Not mm-hmm. that we're not all capable of them, but that's what this system expects, right? If you are going to advance, you have to be willing to step on other people. You have to be willing to exploit other people, if you even, you know, can do that, right? Which is not even an option for a lot of folks, but even though we get taught to think that it is and that that's the highest goal. So I would say that people do what systems expect and people do what systems allow. And I think that this system really expects and enforces that kind of mentality. So it's understandable, I think, why particularly living here kind of draws out those qualities, but that doesn't mean that that's the only way to live, or that, you know, in other contexts or other systems there aren't other possibilities. But I think that some of the other possibilities are kind of stunted for us because of what it is like living in this society.
Definitely stunted. Good way of putting it. And excuse me, also looked at as naive or weak. You know, when I go back to things that I've read regarding, you know, some of it's mythology and almost, you know, written as this ideal place here. What I'm talking about is indigenous folks that when the Europeans came over, you know, they were living more harmoniously. And then the European mentality of conquest came in and looked at that more harmonious mentality as being a weakness, as being, you know, naive. And at the same time, they looked at those folks as savages, and they just were rationalized and in their minds were justified to take and to subjugate and to exterminate. Though, maybe they had it right, if that indeed is the way the folks that were here before Europeans came lived. But we overlooked the insight and the wisdom of that approach. So you remind me of that. I don't know if you ever think of the comparison between what you've heard about indigenous folks here and then the Europeans that came over.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, I'm Indigenous myself. I would say that, you know, that's a, it's valuable insight. I think there's definitely a lot of insights that we can glean from the original peoples of this land and across the world, you know. But ultimately, you know, having a system that works for people doesn't just come down to like our values, right? Because I would say that our values in general, people's values are pretty out of step with what this society is really all about. I mean, I think that it, what you said is right, right? It has to enforce on us every day through a lot of different means. This understanding of selfishness and individualism, that's not necessarily, I don't think, how people would prefer to be or how they really want to be. So I think it comes down to more than just, okay, this is kind of how we, it comes down to more than just values. It also comes down to having the ability to reorganize and reorient society, you know? So that takes a lot, a combination of factors, including having the people power and the unity to be able to create and to actually fight for and enforce an agenda. And then also it takes the development, right, which we've seen over time. Like there's things that have been developed that can actually allow us to achieve what this, it's not a utopia, right? Like we actually can meet people's needs. And we don't have to have a situation where there's 140 million people in this country that are poor or near poor. That doesn't have to be that way, right? There's nothing scientifically or from the realm, the vantage point of what human beings can do or produce that makes that situation necessary. It's just a completely a situation that's enforced because of our economic structure and then the political structure that backs it up.
Wonderfully stated. Excuse me. We're talking to Nijmi Zarinko. She is an activist, a black working class human rights organizer, strategist, co-founder of Put People First PA, among other things, and a regular contributor here on the program, I'm happy to say. Now, we've got philosophical there, which was great. I enjoyed it. Thank you for indulging me. Now let's get a little bit more specific. The Poor People's Campaign. You know, this goes back to the great Dr. King, Dr. Martin Luther King, Reverend Doctor. And what's in place? You know, what is the program, so to speak? What is the plan coming out of the Poor People's Campaign to address all that we're talking about here today?
Yeah, the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, has been taking up the mantle of the original campaign of 1968, which you just referenced. And actually, we've been building up for a number of years. The two national co-convening organizations, which are the Cairo Center and Repairers of the Breach, both of those efforts actually started building toward this moment, even if they weren't totally always aware of it, about 10 years before we relaunched the campaign in 2018. And so 2018 was the 50th anniversary of the original campaign. Now we have coordinating committees who are leading the campaign in over 35 states around the country. And the idea is to, you know, build a movement that is uniting poor and dispossessed people across lines of division, that's based in states, not just in big cities, but all across states in cities and small towns and small cities and rural areas, to really build a shared political agenda. And then build the power to really implement that agenda, which is a process that takes time. But I think we've made a lot of strides in the last 4 years in that process. And that's what the Poor People's Campaign is about, and that's what we're going to D.C. on June 18th, 2022, to kind of take the next step in that process.
So basically, you're exercising your First Amendment right, petitioning the government with your grievances, and, you know, doing that in a way that will unify a lot of folks who have, in your view, common interests, common needs.
Yes, definitely. That's absolutely part of it. And I think also for a lot of us, the development of leaders in that process is really critical as well, right? We're not just saying, okay, we have this set of demands. We do, of course, like we have demands, but we also are building infrastructure on the ground across the country and building people out of that process who are directly impacted, you know, who are not just sort of the talking heads or the experts or the people, you know, that you see on TV, but they're people who really are the leading force in making the changes that we need, because they have the most to gain and the least to lose. And so bringing together thousands of such people from across the country who are really united around an understanding of both the problem and the solution is in itself, I think, a real victory, because we are the most disorganized and disunited and miseducated group of people, right? The folks at the, you know, the bottom half of society. And so actually coming through a process of education and development and unifying to really make our agenda, you know, break into the mainstream is in itself a victory. And I do think that that has been happening in this country through the Poor People's Campaign, right? You see on media now that reference to 140 million people, which is half the country almost, right? That was never talked about before. That wasn't really, there was no light shown on that reality, I don't think, prior to the Poor People's Campaign.
And that you're talking about 140 million people that are poor or near poor.
Correct. Yes, exactly. So that means that we go from feeling like a small group or a marginal group or a group that is only has one interest in one thing to understanding ourselves as actually a massive group with a potentially massive amount of power if it is organized and unified toward the same direction and toward the same goal.
And how do you measure whether someone is poor or near poor? What are you going by?
The Poor People's Campaign uses a supplemental poverty measure index. So the federal poverty line is calculated based on a very outdated standard that is really like it was calculated based only on a food budget. I mean, there's a whole story as to how that came about. But the Poor People's Campaign uses a supplemental poverty index, which takes 200% of that federal poverty line or below. So we calculate it according to people living at 200% or below of the federal poverty line. That's considered poor or near poor. And when you do that calculation, the numbers increase dramatically. And so that's where we get the 140 million number.
You're listening to Troubadours and Rock on Tours with E.W. Conundrum Demure on WFTE Radio, Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Community radio at its finest. Okay, thank you. And then what about division that is, I guess, stoked by those in power and perhaps is almost, again, intrinsic in our culture? inspired by a discomfort or distrust that comes from a physical difference or sexual orientation or what have gender. How do you deal with those divisions? Because I think that's how the powerful keep us from unifying oftentimes, by dividing us through those means.
Yes, absolutely. Divide and conquer is the thing that they're really the best at in a lot of ways. I think that it's important to recognize that we do have differences. We're not all the same. And that's fine. You know, there's no way that we could all be the same. And at the same time, I think that there's a necessity of understanding our position with respect to the basic structures of the economy. So people who have to work, and, you know, not all workers are also the same. Like, people are situated differently in that. But the recognition that if you have to work, or if you have to be subject to the system of work, right? Not everybody is a worker. Some people are not everyone is in the workforce. Some people are unemployed. Some people are caretakers for families, and others, but we still consider them to be workers, right? Mm-hmm. They're not members of the ruling class. And so I think that the basic understanding of the fact that for the vast majority of people, you know, there's lots of things that impact your life. There's lots of parts of your identity that are related to the system and the structure. And also, there's some fundamental similarities that we share with respect to, you know, what our actual position is in the economy and in the basic structures of this society, right? Of how we meet our needs and how things are produced and distributed. And so on that basis, we have a shared interest in transforming this society, right? Like, anyone who's dealing with the fact that you can't rent a 2-bedroom apartment anywhere in this country, there's no county in which you can rent a 2-bedroom apartment on a minimum wage salary working full time. And that's a pretty shared common interest, I would say, right?
Yes.
Like, that's something that affects people regardless of a lot of other things. And it's something that, you know, is a very serious need. We all need a place to live. We need a roof over our head. We need a place for, you know, our families and a place to be safe from the elements. And that's pretty significant, you know. So I think that it's not about saying that we're all the same, but I do think that when we can recognize that what we're up against is pretty significant, you know, there's no way that people are going to just have an insight and say, you know what, I don't like making billions of dollars anymore. I'm going to abdicate, you know, I'm going to give all this up, right? Like, that's not going to happen. So if we can recognize the power that we have, if we can put what we have in common to the front, right, without minimizing our differences, that's kind of what the Poor People's Campaign and other formations are really, really trying to do. Because I do think that there's a difference of opinion, right? There's folks that have different theories of change. And one of those is the idea that you can fight on a specific front and you can make some advances, right? Or what your group needs, you know, you can achieve that without anything else being impacted. And I would say that we just fundamentally don't believe that. You know, we don't actually believe that anything is going to get significantly better for any one particular group without everyone else having to be united to be able to get anything at this stage, especially at this moment in time. So there's differences out there in terms of how people are pursuing this, but that's how we understand it.
Right. And when you say united, I guess in a way that means having a willingness to change and to deal with transformation. And there, you know, there are stresses that come with that sort of across the country, across societal change. There's going to be stresses. There's going to be difficulty in acclimating and maybe giving a little bit, also trusting enough to receive.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's not easy to build unity. That's partly why a lot of people don't do it. In addition to the fact that we have been miseducated in this country very much to believe that it's never happened, or it's never worked, or it's not even possible, or that our differences are so fundamental that we actually don't have common interests. So there's a lot of misunderstandings and miseducation out there. But I think that if we do study and look at history, we'll see that there's actually a huge tradition in this country of people coming together across lines of division. And it has been stamped out not chiefly by those regular people who were trying to do it, but by the powers that be who couldn't allow it to happen. And I think when you understand that history and you learn about that, you realize the real danger that actually poses, the real threat that actually poses to the system. And if we're talking about, you know, being really serious about wanting change, then we have to do the things that we know are actually going to be a true kind of contest to the powers that be, and not things that are just ultimately they can manipulate and control.
Right. And that's a major buy-in you're asking from people. It is inspiring when you hear it. I'm inspired when I talk with you about it. You're so intelligent and you're so earnest. It is inspiring. I'm sure there are several others among the group you work with who are just as inspiring. And then you try to share that, because someone gave it to you and you're trying to pass it on to other folks who want a better life. And I guess that is part of what we are talking about when you discuss building leadership in communities, from the communities. And I guess you're going to do that through workshops, regular, you set up little, schools or what have you, training centers.
Yeah, I think our conception is that our power comes through organization, right? And so in Pennsylvania, for example, the Poor People's Campaign is led by organizations. It's not just led by individuals, right? And so organization means a lot of things. Yeah, it definitely means education. It also means, you know, folks being organized to take on responsibility and have to do things collectively. And it means, you know, working on campaigns, and not saying political campaigns, but issue campaigns that are around these different fronts of struggle, and using those campaigns to highlight and uplift the root cause, not just sort of staying at the surface level, but understanding like what are the root causes of these problems. So I think it's a combination of things in terms of leadership development. It's the being part of an organization, which again, if you have a strong organization that is truly politically independent, then you will give people and help people experience what it's like to be part of something bigger than themselves and have accountability to a collective, and to do things in a thoughtful and collective way, which again is like it's a totally different practice than what most people experience every day, right? So I think it's kind of everything that comes with being part of an organization. I think that's where people get to transform and develop their leadership.
Well, if people want to connect and get involved with the Poor People's Campaign or any of the affiliated organizations, how could they do so, Nijmi?
Yeah, for sure. So when you go to poorpeoplescampaign.org, which is the main website, the national website, you can sign up there and you will get connected to your state campaign, depending on what your address is. You can also look up the different state campaigns, and there's, for instance, a section on the website for Pennsylvania. You go under Find Your State Campaign, and you can see the different organizations that are making up that campaign, whether you're in PA, New York, wherever you are. And so that's the Poor People's Campaign. And then if you're in Pennsylvania, you can go to Put People First PA, which is one of the organizations in the campaign. And that happens to be one that I've co-founded, but there's also many others as well. So poorpeoplescampaign.org and putpeoplefirstpa.org.
And good luck on June 18th. I'm sure you'll be there in D.C. And Nijmi Zarenko, do you have any final couple of words maybe you can share of inspiration, hope, insight?
There's a real power in how we gather as the Poor People's Campaign. We do a lot of singing. We do a lot of art and culture. And that in and of itself is unifying, singing together with people, being in that kind of cultural space. And I think that we're going to hear from a lot of really powerful people from around the country, including, of course, Bishop Barber and Reverend Theo Harris, the two national co-chairs. And I think it's going to be one of those events that, you know, you're always going to remember. You know, you're going to be like, I was there. At that moment, I think this is a really profound moment in our country. I think there's a lot of polarization happening in a lot of places, and it's a really important time for this movement to continue to break through. And I just would love for everybody who's listening to this to really be able to be a part of that. And if you go to poorpeoplescampaign.org, there will be a pop-up there immediately that where you can register for June 18th, and then you can find a seat on a bus. You don't have to figure out your own way there. You can get on a bus that will be leaving from points around the whole country, and you can be with us on June 18th for the Mass Poor People's and Low-Wage Workers Assembly and Moral March on Washington into the polls.
It sounds great, Nijmi. Thanks so much, Nijmi Zarenko. I really appreciate your time and all the work you're doing, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you, Lawrence. Likewise. Take care.
And now, an excerpt from a story by Bruce Ballinger titled The Memory of Clay, published in the May 2022 edition of The Sun magazine. Yesterday, hidden behind two circular saw cases on a deep shelf under my workbench, I found my father's bench plane, the tool he used for smoothing and straightening wood. It was in sorry shape. The blade was gouged, the wooden handle hopelessly loose, and, worst of all, the metal body of the plane was cracked. Though it was beyond repair, I briefly entertained the idea of sharpening it anyway. Marcel Proust famously wrote about how the taste of Madeleine soaked in lime blossom triggered childhood memories of his aunt's room, which, quote, rose up like a stage set. Well, holding my father's broken bench plane suddenly brought back his basement workshop. Dad had power tools of every kind, a bandsaw, a table saw, a lathe, a drill press. It was a woodworker's shop, and it smelled of old dogs and aged sawdust. On metal shelves next to his workbench, Dad kept all kinds of wires, shims, hooks, and screws in brown cigar boxes. And behind a box of large nuts and bolts, he hid his booze. He would often disappear down there, a sober man with a job to do, and come back drunk, leaving behind unfinished projects in his crooked wake. I inherited my father's tools after he died. I recognize them still, not only by their age, but by the red slash of fingernail polish that still shows through the dust, rust, and dirt. Dad began marking all his tools this way after a neighbor borrowed one and failed to return it. Seeing these marks of ownership 70 years after Dad made them brings back images of him in the basement workshop, brushing sawdust off a fresh rip cut and looking sideways at a half-made drawer, his mind at work calculating his next move, where to measure, where to cut, and what tool to use. It's an old story that a boy grows up to measure himself against his father. It's unavoidable, really, and made more complicated when that father is deeply flawed. For all Dad's skill with wood and tools, his life was sloppily built. Some sorrow, whose origins I can't name, led him to consistently misread the ruler. What does a son do with the wreckage of his father's life 46 years after his death? Mostly, I avoid thinking about it, except for those inescapable moments when a slash of red nail polish brings him back, or a gap opens in my miscut wood joint, and I'm reminded that I can misread a ruler, too. My daughter Julia, a ceramicist, was telling me the other day about her struggles to make clay pieces in the image of an upright figure with outstretched arms. She calls these, quote, ritual keepers, and they are designed to hold incense sticks. After being fired in the kiln, her figures would often come out leaning forward instead of standing up straight, as if they were gazing at the ground. Julia says that clay, especially fine clay like porcelain, has a memory, and making her ritual keepers stand up straight is, quote, intrinsically against their nature. Raw, unformed clay wants to be round like the earth and yields only reluctantly to the potter's will. When it does, she says, it typically remembers the first shape it was forced to assume. In the case of Julia's ritual keepers, which were flattened with a slab ruler, they remember the press of the ruler and stubbornly insist on retaining its curve. These memories of my father are stubbornly pressed, too, no matter how hard I've tried to straighten them. bloom so. It amazes, the yellow light of the sun, how warm and rich it illuminates the chlorophyll green leaves on the white birch trees. The water seeks deeper and downhill. Flowers bloom so many colors, still in the wet wash of yesterday's rain showers and this morning's unconscious dew, despite me and you.
I can't sail my yacht. He's taken everything I got. All I've got's this sunny afternoon. Save me, save me, save me from this squeeze. I got a big fat mama trying to break me. So pleasantly live this life of luxury, blazing on a sunny afternoon in the summertime. Now I'm sitting here, sipping at my ice cold beer, blazing on the sunny afternoon. Help me, help me, help me sail away. Well, give me two good reasons why I ought to stay.
And there you have it, episode 475 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, Nijmi Zarenko, writer Bruce Ballinger and the Sun Magazine, and these musical artists: Thelonious Monk, Rage Against the Machine, Supergrass, Liz Fair, Rye Cooter, The Kinks, Branford Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard too. And of course, I would like to thank you for listening. Until next time, let's give it a go and do our best with this time. Take care of yourself and others too. Toodaloo.